The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's July 24th, 2024, and it's 2:37 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. Thanks again for finding the Mincing Rascals. We broadcast this podcast Saturday nights at 8, and you can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now writing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Marge Halperin, Democratic analyst. I do commentary for CTV, the national news network in Canada, here on the Mincing Rascals, drawing on decades of experience as a journalist, a government reformer, and community organizer, doing what I can to challenge authority.
Eric is not with us this week. Eric Zorn probably wishes he was. We had another one of those "where were you when you heard the news" moments last weekend when Sunday afternoon President Biden, succumbing to pressure from Eric Zorn, announced that he will not run for re-election. Just about 100 days from Election Day and a couple of weeks from the DNC here in Chicago. Looks like Kamala Harris will be at the top of the ticket. So today, was Biden's decision correct? Is Harris the best to replace him? Who should be number two? Where were you when you heard the news, Austin?
Wow.
How did you find out?
I found out from Twitter, which I think the past 2 to 4 weeks, I don't think I've ever consumed Twitter, X, formerly Twitter, more than in the past month. And I think that's the case for many people. I think they have record usage. And the fact that that news was broken on that platform, I think, is really, really notable and kind of unprecedented in American history for news of that consequence. So I think it, you know, not only was the content extraordinary, but the method was really extraordinary. And the fact that we haven't heard from the president really since then, I believe we're supposed to tonight, right?
Yeah, right. He was sequestering himself because of his own bout of COVID. But really, so the fact that he posted it on X as opposed to telling the world in person was notable. I hadn't thought about it that way. Kate, where were you when you heard the word? How did you hear?
I was on vacation this past week. I have a yearly vacation with a group of girlfriends. And first, I got a text from my husband Saturday night saying, "Biden's out." And then 2 seconds later, another text, "Oh, sorry, fake news." Then the next day, of course, it was real. And it was interesting because about half of us wanted to just sit down and devour the news and just tune into cable TV, and half of us were people who absolutely did not want to hear a single word about anything. So it created a little bit of a clash there. Not because anyone was unhappy that Biden had stepped aside, but half the people just have had it up to here with politics and didn't want to hear a single word.
So yeah, that, I understand that,
I found that an interesting response. Yeah.
I won't judge the people that have that attitude. I don't know that you are either, but I mean, I'm not.
Some of my closest friends, by definition, have that attitude. It made it hard, though, for the rest of us to having to kind of sneak around looking at we're on vacation.
Yeah, I got to go to the bathroom, really. And an hour later, right. you come out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Marge, where and when for you?
Grandchildren are visiting, so I got a hectic household around here this week. And I got a call from Canada. My CTV producer said, "Will you come? How soon can you come on? Talk about Biden stepping down." I'm like, "Biden stepped down?" Yeah, Sunday afternoon in the household, we were not prepared for that news.
Canada told you. That's funny.
I
was talking to my parents and my phone dinged. By the way, my phone has been dinging now with solicitation for donations like it has never before. It's bing, bing, bing. Kamala wants money. Everybody wants money. The parties and the support groups and everything. And I'm just like, wow. You know, that idea that if you bug people too much, you're going to alienate them. They did not get that memo. And I don't know if you guy saw the amount of money that the two campaigns have. I asked producer Pete just to see what he could find. And Biden-Harris has a campaign fund. And then there's the allied PACs and agencies. And then similarly for Donald Trump, they both have about, if you aggregate the campaign and the support groups, about $500 million apiece. It's almost $1 billion in the bank now, with 100 days to spend it in Ohio. I don't think we're going to see many of those commercials. I don't think we're going to see many of those ads here, and just as well. Was it the right decision? And should Kamala be at the top of the ticket?
Well, of course it was the right decision. Of course, since I've been recommending it for months now, I feel it was the right decision. And I'm not at all surprised that President Biden did come back about a half hour later and endorse Kamala Harris. And there was pretty universal coalescing behind her. Not 100%. It's interesting who did not. Even President Obama, as far as I can see, has so far still not come out and endorsed her. He did specifically call for an open process instead. And he has not come back and pulled that back and said, no, fine, let's just stick with Kamala Harris. Obviously, everyone else by now has coalesced behind her. And I'm not surprised by that, like I said, but I am a little disappointed because I did hope, I had a tiny sliver of hope that the Democratic Party might have done a little soul searching and understood that they got us to this terrible point by suppressing the competition to begin with in the 2024 primaries. I really feel that Kamala Harris would be a much stronger candidate, or whoever came out of an open process, which, you know, let's be real, even an open process would be the Democratic Party elite choosing a couple of other top people to have a very tightly choreographed and staged maybe couple of debates between themselves.
You would have wanted a brokered convention. You didn't want an open floor, but you wanted, well, I guess you would. You would want that. And preliminary to that, you wanted in the next couple of weeks some sort of debates with the governors and Kamala Harris, huh?
I would. And that's not a bizarre out there idea. Nancy Pelosi was specifically recommending that in private. Clearly, she had not been brought in advance on the idea.
I agree with Kate. I was hoping for some kind of condensed process. But when you saw proposals for that, whether they were Nancy Pelosi's sort of vague comments or Nate Silver, a little more detailed, Ezra Klein had a more detailed idea also, but no one put dates on it. And I couldn't figure out how you would pack any kind of process into basically a month in order to get it done before the convention. It doesn't seem like you need that early vote for Ohio anymore, although they're going to do it. So I saw a press release this morning. I think it came out from Black Lives Matter saying, you know, while we're celebrating, we should realize there was no process and there should have been one. No one has said what the process would be in 4 weeks, and I can't quite imagine one. I like that she went after the delegates right away, and the delegates are elected. They're elected by every state to make the decision. There's this idea in some of the commentary I've seen that this circumvents the democratic process, but actually the process is more about electing the delegates who ultimately vote. We declare who we like through the primary process, but then we elect the delegates who choose at the convention.
Do you know who your delegate is?
Yeah, I think my delegates are all elected officials. I think Danny Davis is my delegate.
But the reason I'm asking, Marge, is I want to push back a little bit on it. I mean, those are the rules that the Democratic Party has, and they can choose their candidate any way they want. But I understand that it feels a little top down. It is a group of people that either way will determine who the candidate, maybe the next president of the United States, is. That doesn't feel all that democratic to me. If you voted for Joe Biden in the primaries, they forced Joe Biden off the ticket. And now somebody else who you don't know, in a process that most of us don't understand, is now going to pick the candidate for the Democratic Party. And if it's Kamala Harris, maybe the next president of the United States.
Well, you should know who they are because they're on the ballot.
Wait a minute. If I voted for Joe Biden, the name of the delegate was next to that?
You voted separately for the delegates, and the name of Joe Biden was next to them.
I don't remember that. I got to get the ballot out. I mean, it seems to me like I went into a thing, and there was Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and I picked one of those, right?
And
by the way, even if I knew who the delegate was and I really liked my delegate, it's not about the delegate. They're just the mail carrier for me to then exercise my vote. But now that guy that I wanted them to vote for is not there. So now I've given full authority to that person to pick anybody they want.
Well, we are definitely not thinking about it correctly if we think it's a very democratic process to begin with. The parties are their own little corporations. It's not really composed of all of us. They're really the people choosing the nominees, and it is their group. They're the ones doing all the work for it. So I can see that. I agree with you, March, totally, that the people claiming that asking Biden to step down, whether you want to say they're asking him or forcing him, is somehow making the whole thing undemocratic. I agree with you that's not the case. These are private political parties. But by the same token, I don't think they were pursuing as democratic a process as they could have with the primaries.
Right.
They doubled down even more than usual this cycle in making sure that they got the nominee that they wanted.
Well,
really, the Democratic Party made sure that there was nobody else on the ballot anywhere that they could manage to do that. There were several states, I think we all know, Tennessee, North Carolina, Massachusetts. I forget where else, where the state parties made a point of not allowing Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson even on the ballot.
Your boy, Dean Phillips.
Yeah, my boy.
Who would have changed the result
before our contest? I voted for him anyway, but it meant nothing.
Who do you think would have been doing the biggest touchdown dance in the world, by the way? And I've not heard anything from. He was like, he's the one, you know, most prominent person who called the shot, I would think, and he's, put his money where his mouth was. And
he was really classy about it. Yeah, he was very classy.
Are you serious? He was? He's the Minnesota congressman who said, I want to challenge Joe Biden in the primary because he's not our best candidate. Not that he probably for a minute thought that he was, but Marge is going, who knows? But
he probably thought he was.
Yeah, I guess. But the best candidate, the best Democrat to take on Donald
Trump.
Marianne
Williamson thought she's the best candidate more than once.
They're delusional.
For what it's worth, Dean Phillips was very clear that he did not expect people would think that a second-term congressperson was the best to run against the president. It was very clear from the very beginning that he had attempted to get other people to run instead of him, and that nobody else would do it, and that he was simply hoping that by kind of widening that Overton window, getting out there, being the first person to test the waters, that other people would have the courage to jump in.
And they didn't. And so maybe he was prescient, at least in that events would transpire that would make you wish you had other candidates to choose from.
Right.
But we didn't know then what we know now.
Right. But in any situation, if the candidate is forced to campaign just a little bit, then you can get an idea of what their strengths and weaknesses are. If President Biden had subjected himself to even the most basic process, we would have seen his issues very directly, very early on, and we wouldn't be in this situation.
Well, I'm confused by that because I'm pretty sure he campaigned. He went through key primaries and we saw him out in various states. He didn't campaign in Illinois very much. He didn't have to.
He was speaking on teleprompter. He wasn't having to engage in a debate the way he just did.
Or an open press conference.
Exactly.
I want to be clear, though. I don't want to be misinterpreted, John. I don't mean that the process used is undemocratic. I meant to say I think it was democratic because we elected the delegates to the convention, and they're by slate. So you're voting for Biden, you vote for the Biden delegates, that's your choice. But you could have. I don't know who else was on our ballot. Biden delegates myself.
Well, Dean Phillips was there, but he didn't mean anything at that point.
But it's a semblance of a democratic process.
Okay.
A semblance.
Well, down after the primary's done, we don't have a process for that because it never happened before.
Well, and I don't think it's that critical. Austin, I want you to talk here too, but I just don't think it's that critical because what really matters is the election itself, and that is democratic. It's not a club that you do or don't belong to.
There's a really interesting, actually, parallel that I don't think anyone's pointed out yet in Illinois regarding this whole process of what do we do in a primary? And I maybe talked about this on the Mincing Rascals, but there was a bill signed into law by Governor Pritzker earlier this year that stopped the process of slating for state elections or state house elections. And this was criticized as sort of an incumbency protection program. And the way slating works in Illinois is, say you're in a rural Republican district and no Democrats run in the Democrat Party for your state representative.
Which happens.
Well, yeah, which happens all the time. And similarly, maybe if you're in the South Side of Chicago and there's no Republican on the primary mm-hmm. ballot for mm-hmm. your state representative. So in the interest of having more competitive elections, there's a process by which the party can say, okay, nobody ran in the primary, but we want to have this person, maybe usually it's like, ward committeeman or something like that, vote to quote unquote slate that person for the election so that voters have a choice. Now, what happened this year is that there was a law passed that said in the middle of the process, by the way, we're not doing slating anymore. So this is after people had decided whether or not to run in the primary, after the parties had made choices, and then they passed this law. What's really funny about this is House Speaker Chris Welch intervened in that lawsuit, and his argument was we had to end slating because voters should pick the party's candidates, not the parties. And then an appeals court ruled in favor of the folks suing against this new law. So it's not on the books currently. It was struck down. But then Speaker Welch appealed to the state Supreme Court, and he made the same argument about the importance of voters picking their candidates, not the party. And now, like in the greatest of ironies, we're going to have Welch's political party pick its presidential candidate at the convention in Chicago without the voters, with delegates. So that it's a really interesting contrast,
in between. Is the value of that, Austin, that you would at least give, say, a Republican in Chicago or a Democrat downstate a way to sound off, a way to vote? Because sometimes there literally isn't a candidate of your choosing on the ballot. So mm-hmm. we'll just put a name on there, some committeemen or something like that, even though they didn't run and they know they're not going to win. But you now get to mark their name because you don't want to vote for the other guy.
That's right. And there's lots of studies that show simply just having an option for the opposing party increases voter turnout, even if it's on down ballot elections. So it's a good thing for increasing voter participation to have folks on the ballot. That law, thankfully, is currently being prevented from coming into place.
Well, whatever the process, Austin, do you think that Kamala Harris is the best choice for Democrats in this upcoming election?
Well, last week I said I don't think Joe Biden was stepping down, so take my opinion with a grain of salt. But I think if he were to step down, Kamala was the only feasible choice because no one else who was in the mix had anywhere close to the name ID of Kamala Harris. I mean, I think there's only like 1% of registered voter, likely voters that don't know who she was compared to you go down the list. And it was like, I was surprised. J.B. Pritzker, it was something like 42% of voters didn't know who J.B. Pritzker was. And I think he was the least known of anyone being considered for the VP pick. I thought that was pretty interesting. But yeah, in terms of if you had to pick someone, you have to pick her. I think there's also this, you have to think of it as who's going to give you, if you're going to have Joe Biden drop out, you're doing that so that you have a bigger variance. It's not like this person's definitely going to win, but like, hey, maybe there's a better shot that they could win. Maybe if polling numbers move. But so far, there's been a lot of talk about how Kamala Harris is sort of energizing the youth vote, energizing the female vote. And I don't think that is showing up in like, there's a lot more TikTok memes about Kamala Harris.
Oh, there. It's quite a thing right now.
It's a deluge. It's a deluge of memes. It's reminiscent. It's the first time I've actually seen something akin to Trump 2016 on social media. So I think it is notable. But in terms of the polling, CNN did a great segment on this actually. But with voters under age 35, Biden beat Trump by 21 points in 2020. And that was a key. He would not have won the election if not for that margin. Beating Trump by 21 points with voters under age 35. And in polling since Sunday, Harris versus Trump, she is only plus 9. So she's going to need, like, as is, Kamala Harris is not going to beat Donald Trump, according to the polls that have come out so far. She's going to need to create more momentum, withstand the onslaught of negative attacks that are going to come against her, because that margin is really steep. And in terms of the energy, similar polling, the asking Democrats, are you more motivated to vote after Biden left the race? Are you more motivated to vote after Biden left the race? Overall, 39% of Democrats said they were more likely, but 55% said they were not more likely. And then age 18 to 29, 42% said they were more likely, 49% said that they were not likely. So far, I don't think you see this sort of big surge. She's going to have to do a lot more to win.
Well, there's no elephant in the room, right? There's no Barack Obama in the wings. There's no Bill Clinton in the wings. There's no body that they say, oh, man, you guys should have picked Shapiro. I'm telling you, he's a rock star. People don't know who Shapiro is either. I mean, maybe they know him better than J.B. Pritzker, but I don't.
Gretchen Whitmer, you know, it was
a there you go.
Primary. I'd have gone for Whitmer. Whitmer Warnock was a very appealing.
Would she be your number two, Marge?
No. For Kamala Harris, no.
Yeah.
I like Mark Kelly. I would go with Kelly, except that leaves the Senate seat open, and that's a big risk for the party right now.
You do have a Democrat governor there, though, that would appoint at least a seat filler for him, right?
For now, right, that's right. And then there'll be an election, and we'll see. But he is my top choice over Shapiro. They seem to be the two really in the running, right?
Yeah, yeah. You got a dog you like in that hunt, Kate?
For the Veep?
Yeah.
For the Veep spot?
Yeah.
I would be really Machiavellian and also go with Mark Kelly. As we know, his wife is Gabby Giffords, and he kind of takes some of that sympathy for Trump for getting shot vote away, or at least dilutes it a little
wow.
bit. I know it's really Machiavellian, but it's real. Astronaut? Come on.
I'll tell you what, though. The identity politics of all of this, Austin, is really amazing to me, too. That is, you can't have Gretchen Whitmer because you can't have two ladies on the ticket. You can't have a black person or a person of color because you've already got one on the ticket. So you got to have a white male from a geographical place that's good and then say, okay, well, then that's that. So there's just a couple boxes to check, and you hardly even know who's inside those boxes. I don't know if I made that point on the podcast last week. Maybe I did. I know I made it on the radio, but it really is interesting to me how we're sort of picking this all-important second pick without really much knowledge about the person except their ID, Austin.
Yeah, that's true. And you look at someone like an Andy Beshear in Kentucky, and a lot of people are talking about him because he's in a Democrat. He's been successful in Kentucky. Wow, look at that. Well, people aren't talking about the fact that his dad was an enormously popular politician in Kentucky for many, many years. It doesn't necessarily mean that his likability is going to translate to the whole nation. And the other bit of identity politics that's interesting is Josh Shapiro, you would think, would be a really, really, you know, the front runner. That is a state that that Biden really needs to win. He's been successful in sort of beating back MAGA attacks in Pennsylvania. But does picking a Jewish vice president signal things to the far left of the party that they're not going to take the issue of Israel-Palestine seriously, or, you know, they're going to advance Israel's interests instead of the interests of the Palestinian people? That's a huge identity politics question, I think, that factors into this. Meanwhile, I think the Trump camp, to their detriment, did not consider hardly any of that. I think they considered age and kind of loyalty. J.D. Vance was not running, I think, as a really, really odd pick. He ran behind many other Republicans in Ohio. He's like the least popular Republican statewide official in Ohio, compared to the governor and compared to Trump, like by a lot. So, I think if you're Trump, you're regretting making that pick now that Biden's out of the race.
And Kamala particularly is on the front of the presumptive front of the ticket. If the Republicans knew that Kamala would be at the top of the ticket, don't you think they would have diversified their second pick, their VP pick?
I think absolutely it would be more likely that there would be a woman vice presidential nominee.
Nikki Haley, maybe, or something like that.
It's Trump's choice, though, and whatever goes through his fevered brain is what happens. I didn't really have anything to go on when I guessed he would pick Vance, just that he's crazy. And I figured he'd kind of like to see that craziness in Vance with him. And that was all I was thinking.
I really think it was the timing of it, though, too, because he thought, all right, you've got Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. This thing is over. I thought that the polling showed this week that Kamala Harris, polls taken since Joe Biden dropped out, that she was essentially even in a popular vote, maybe not in an electoral one, but that she polls even with Donald Trump. Am I getting the wrong information here, guys?
No, I think that's correct. I had a survey from an organization called Rust Belt Rising that did Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. They started on Saturday, so they started a day and a half before the announcement was made, but they went through Tuesday, so it overlaps a little bit. Nonetheless, they found overall Harris 45, Trump 46, and Michigan Harris and Trump even at 46, in Pennsylvania, Trump ahead slightly 46-44, in Wisconsin, they were even again 48-48. So a bit of movement there, and certainly on the cusp of the Biden announcement, she was doing better than Biden in those battlegrounds.
Do you all think that policies that Kamala Harris, I mean, let's suppose that for some reason people are going to vote on policies and would they be good or bad for America? Is there anything to distinguish Kamala Harris from Joe Biden? Is it a different election or is it the same issue and really the same team, just somebody else is quarterbacking it now?
She needs to answer that question. And I think she needs to separate herself somewhat. But you're right, Austin, I haven't seen it yet. In the 2020 election, she stepped out fairly far to the left on several issues, Green Deal and some others that she's going to have to walk back. But it's 4 years later and she's got her record in D.C. now, and she can redefine herself, but she doesn't have a lot of time to do that. So I think the answer to that question is going to be important, and we don't know.
Yeah, it's very, very untested on things like foreign policy. She's not had to talk a lot about, with the exception of the border, which you could consider foreign policy. She did have her marquee tax proposal when she was running for the nomination was called, I believe, the LIFT Act, and it was essentially universal basic income. It would have cost something like $3 trillion over a decade. Would have been really bad for inflation. Other than that, I have not seen any meaningful distinction between a Kamala Harris platform and Joe Biden's platform.
And maybe there doesn't need to be. I mean, you know, if as Marge said last week, we have a good message, but we have a bad messenger, we being the Democratic Party that you work so hard for, maybe Kamala can carry the ball across the goal line. I mean, I don't know what I would ask her to do to make her more competitive, other than, you know, maybe back away from some of those super progressive things that she was labeled with 4 years ago. I think if she said, I don't believe this, but I'll finish the sentence, things are going pretty well, and we need to persuade you of it, that would be effective. But I don't think that's an effective message, to be honest with you.
People who are hurting when they go to the grocery store or the gas pump don't like to be told, no, you're not.
Yeah, okay.
She's in a tough spot, yeah. I mean, and definitely one of her biggest issue probably is that she is bringing all the baggage of the Biden administration with her, and she's going to have to be so very careful in distancing herself in some useful ways to get past that. It's going to be really hard. It'll be very interesting to see how she attempts to do that. I hope she does. So far, and of course, I mean, she's just started, right? So far, all I've heard is just the concept of attacking Donald Trump For being a convicted felon, for being someone who has been convicted of sexual assault as well. Of course, we all are horrified by that, but we already know that that's not really effective with certainly with his base, but also hasn't made a big inroad apparently among undecideds either. So she does need to go beyond that.
She's not a wild card, though, Kate, but don't you sense in the country a renewed energy, a real game change has happened here? I mean, where people were just on the left, just, you know, couldn't imagine what the convention was going to be like. And actually, there's still questions about how you incorporate Joe Biden into it. But I mean, now there's an energy out there that you would never have associated with Kamala Harris. But since she's not Joe Biden, and the dynamic of a prosecutor debating a convicted felon is kind of intriguing, this whole thing is upside down now. It's really a different ballgame.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you that that energy is very much out there, and it's really refreshing. And there's no doubt that we're in a much, much better place. My fear, though, is that it's a bump. And she's going to have to keep that bump up, not just up, but get it much higher. Mm-hmm. Because as we all know, the Democrat has to do substantially better on the popular vote to overcome that Republican Electoral College.
Yeah, right, right. Advantage. That's so true. Although I wonder if she will benefit from it being a shorter runway to the election. The energy's out there. I'm not Joe Biden. Next thing you know, we're voting, and maybe she doesn't have enough time to screw it up and can capitalize on the energy that's out there.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully there wouldn't be as much time for the kind of, you know, Oppo research hit pieces that you might have more time to do.
Although the commercials are out there already. I don't know if you've all seen some of them.
Of course. And what am I talking about? They've been getting them ready all this time.
One interesting thing is the little debate that's been going on in the last 24 hours where you see the most right-wing MAGA folks in Congress calling her a DEI hire, like, you know, like a token hire, basically, DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, right?
Yeah.
And they're anti making space for people of color. So they're claiming she's just an empty vessel. They picked her because she's Black, Asian, you know. But this morning, there are stories out that House Speaker Johnson in his caucus told his people, stop doing that.
Yeah.
Because you're insulting all the people of color. We want Latino, we want Black voters to support Republicans. We can't mock them. And then, you know, there's Trump's line about Black jobs. One of my favorite memes now is a picture of Harris. This is a Black job, because he made a derogatory comment about how he's increased Black jobs. Like, is there any job, right? So they've got a race issue that they have to peel back somehow, and they're apparently already worried about how to do it, and that's going to be interesting.
Well, of course, Black and Latino men had been moving more towards Trump the last few months. So yeah. if they go on this big DEI rant, they could very well, push that back again.
Well, they're different characters and personalities, but I always felt that Barack Obama benefited from his race in his first election. I don't know. Austin, do you think that Kamala Harris would enjoy the same advantage by being a person of color, or is that a disadvantage or neither?
I think the context in which race is discussed in America has completely changed, especially on the left since 2008 and since the Obama campaign. I do think that Kamala Harris would be wise to take lessons from how Obama discussed race in that context, because I think post George Floyd, there has been there's the way that the left broadly has talked about those issues has not only repelled some working class white voters, it is, as Kate was mentioning, also doesn't resonate with a lot of Latino voters and a lot of Black male voters. So I think that would be a good thing for the country if similar to, you know, a 2008 Obama campaign, that issue was discussed, I guess.
And you don't see her championing her minority status, do you?
Well, of course, we haven't really heard a lot from her as vice president.
Period. Yeah.
So that, for me, that remains to be seen.
She was on a call last night with 40,000 Black women.
Yeah, there's a Zoom call. Imagine how tiny the little screens were that on her laptop.
You get to see everybody. But yeah, so yeah. she'll build her coalition any way she can, but she's not expecting to coast in as the first Black woman to be elected. That's not her. Yeah. That's not her theme. You're right about that.
Okay, more about this topic next week. And one more topic for us to discuss today. But before that, we want to thank and welcome our new sponsor for the Mincing Rascals. And it's the city of Ottawa, Illinois. They say it's the middle of everywhere. Enjoy all the boating, biking, and hiking in Ottawa's fresh outdoor space. Settle down, snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms, everything from hotels and luxury resorts to private rentals and B&Bs. Plan your trip today at visitottawail.com. This message is brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. July 6th in Springfield, Sonia Massey called police to report someone poking around her home. The police arrived in Springfield. They canvassed her property, and as we see on body cam footage, were eventually let inside. There, they found a 36-year-old woman in a kind of disheveled home, distracted by something on her phone, not speaking all that clearly. The officers were courteous and seemed to be doing good police work. When they told her to turn off her stove, there appeared to be a pot of water, possibly boiling there. She walked over, picked up the pot, and said to one of the officers, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus." And that's when things went south fast. Guns drawn, one screamed, "I'll shoot your effing face off." And a matter of seconds later, he did pull the trigger, delivering a fatal shot to her head. I asked a psychologist who works with first responders today to tell us how it is that officers can act so quickly, so rashly, and so differently from one moment to the next. They were doing what you would hope an officer would do in a situation like that, even for a lady that was curious. And the next thing you know, they have their guns drawn, two of them, and shoot her, not point blank, but very nearby. By the way, the psychologist that I had on, guys, then explained to me how officers are in a unique position, and she kind of walked us through the psychology of why they sometimes pull the trigger or make a mistake and pull the trigger. But she sounded very sympathetic to them being threatened by a pot of boiling water. This is where Eric Zorn throws up his hands and says, okay, what are we going to do about this? What, you know, we always come to these kinds of stories and we have nothing constructive to say or do about it. And I appreciate that, but I don't want to just ignore this one because it seems so egregious, didn't it? It seems so absolutely unnecessary. And I can't get my head around how a police officer gets up and has no intention of killing somebody today, particularly in a circumstance where it doesn't feel like they need to pull the trigger at all. I mean, he knows the body cam is on. The instant they shoot her, you can tell they both regret it. And he must know that now my life is over. I may go to jail now for something I just did. So I think it's important then to ask, why would the officer do that? He has no intention of ruining his life. And ruining this lady's life is certainly going to do that. So then what happens there?
From what we know, he was clearly unfit to be a police officer in the first place. And I think that's where a lot of the conversation should
Why do you say that?
Well, for one, he was at, I believe, six different departments.
In 4 years. In 4 years, yeah.
For Pawnee, Kincaid, Verdon, Auburn, Logan County, Sangamon County.
Yeah.
Since 2021. And he was part-time at, I believe, three of those.
Yeah.
And they're still, according to the AP reporting, the AP is looking into his employment records at those places. Now, it could certainly be the case that maybe, you know, there could be other life circumstances that, you know.
Or maybe that was the career ladder up. A couple of part-time jobs, and then someday you get to work in the state capitol.
Potentially. We don't know. He resigned from the Logan County Sheriff's Office, Auburn, and Verdon. And then I think the reason was other, as listed for Kincaid and Pawnee. So yeah. I don't think we know. So
a couple of DUIs, too.
Yeah, right. And so there's, I think it's important to look at the professionalization of police. It's important to look at what kinds of accountability measures are in place to get officers like this off of the force before this an incident like this happens. Of course, in the case of police, there will always just be tragedies that cannot be prevented because it's a profession that deals with a lot of violence and a lot of trauma. And there's lots of crazy things that happen when you're a police officer. But there are things we can do to prevent people like this from being on the force. Illinois Policy Institute actually did a great study in 2022 looking at across the 10 largest cities in Illinois, what were the provisions in the police union contracts that hindered accountability and discipline? Now, accountability and discipline is not a problem here when this person, you know, this officer shot a woman and killed her, that he will be held accountable for that. But what about any kind of warning signs before that? So, for example, in Springfield, we found that in the police union contract, this was 2022, I believe they have a new contract since then, but I would suspect that this is still in it. The city of Springfield prohibits anonymous complaints against officers. You have to sign an affidavit to even lodge a complaint against a police officer in Springfield. That's in the union contract. They also restrict the interrogation of officers. So after an incident like this happens, there are a lot of restrictions on when you can review the officer, what information they're allowed to get beforehand. And further, the types of investigations into discipline are often hidden from public review after the fact in Springfield. Those records are destroyed or most people are not allowed to get them. So those are some very simple things that you can use to increase the odds that bad apple police officers are caught sooner before there's a tragedy.
If say he was fired for cause from one of those previous jobs, do the other police departments know about it? And do police departments generally have policies that if you are fired for cause, then we will not hire you?
Oftentimes, I don't think so. I don't think there's a centralized database like that in Illinois. And it's a really big concern because you see things, this is often called pass the trash, right? If you're fired from a government job for cause, you can go to another job. You saw this, like the most extreme example of this, this was sort of an open secret in Indiana where there were basketball coaches that were known to have problems with sexual assault and harassment of minors. And they would bop around to different high schools without in leave town, you know, before they were caught. So that's another, I think, reform that should be on the table.
Sounds like the Catholic Church a little bit, doesn't it? And moving priests to other parishes.
I agree with all that you're saying, Austin. The union does limit and protect its officers as part of a job of the union, but the job of the city is to push back and have a more open process to protect people. One other thing, now I didn't watch the video. We were all warned it would be horrible, and I did not watch it. But I understand that there's an indication there that the officer discouraged his... Not only did he refuse to provide any medical assistance, he tried to discourage his partner from getting a medical kit.
That's
and
correct.
Providing her
That's
any
correct.
Aid. Yeah. He did so nonetheless. And I believe his partner didn't pull his weapon, right?
That's
so what made him think
also.
He needed to... And what I was thinking while you were sharing all that information, John, is about those studies. You know, there have been studies that show the propensity, you know, they're little computerized tests where they show you face after face and are you going to shoot or not? And whether they're white or black officers, they're more likely to shoot when they see a black face. And they're so fundamentally, the training that's necessary for officers is woefully, woefully lacking. Look at all, you know, you see TV news items all the time about how they're training officers and they come in and they get good footage of them fighting and being aggressive and come on in and you learn all these maneuvers. They don't show them in any kind of gaining any kind of skills about de-escalation.
Yeah.
I'd like to see what that looks like. That maybe doesn't make good TV news, but it ought to. And I don't think there's nearly enough solid training of officers anywhere, almost anywhere in the country.
Yeah. The officers are white and the victim here is black. And I'm well aware of that. But I also haven't felt that was such a mitigating factor because I didn't process it in racial terms so much as just the absolute power dynamic. These police officers are enormous. The one guy looks like a tight end for a football team. The other guy seems to be similarly sized, and they've got guns. And then it's this other human being over here who, on the other side of a kitchen in a bathrobe, has a little pot with some water. You know, that was the power dynamic I noticed. Maybe race played a factor. Would they have been less likely to pull the trigger if she were white? I get that.
The psychologist you talked to, John, who made the point that she's a former officer and that she had been in life-threatening situations, it was really interesting to listen to your interview with her, and it was useful that she came from that perspective of almost sounding like his defense attorney, so that you certainly felt like you were hearing the best possible argument on his behalf.
Such as it was.
And I took her point that it doesn't necessarily make a difference to whether or not a police officer's life is in danger that he's a big guy and you're a small woman. Certainly doesn't matter when it's a gun. I could understand her point that doesn't necessarily matter if you're talking about a big pot of boiling water. So I wouldn't necessarily call that not threatening. And she also made the point that when we see footage from the body cams, that the police officers look like they're farther away than they are.
Yeah.
And I still could not fathom that instantaneous turn that the events took. And it was still so strange because the police officer seemed to be engaging in kind of friendly banter with her.
Yeah.
Well, we don't want to see that, you know, boiling water cause a problem. And then she said something back to him also about the boiling water. And he kind of responded. And that's when she said, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus." But, you know, when you see that
twice.
Written out.
Yeah.
When you see, she did say it twice because he said, "What did you say?"
I know. I don't even know what that means, but keep going. Yeah.
The psychologist you had on made the interesting point that when someone feels threatened like that, their limbic system kind of takes over and their front lobe, as she put it, which makes decisions, goes away.
But at that point, Kate, she was also talking about the continuum of response, that the police officers, if they say you need to do something, you don't do it, then they are allowed to now use something, a more forceful measure to get you to comply. So you could hit somebody with an open hand if they haven't responded verbally. And the opportunities for you to escalate your response if you're the police officer go up as long as the person isn't responding. But I said to her, at some point there has to be a stop where you can't shoot somebody in the head if they have a pot of water and they don't put the pot of water down.
Absolutely.
And that's where that all falls apart.
Yeah. I would never have said that she stopped obeying their orders. They told her to go do something about the boiling water. She was going to put it in her sink. Then she made that "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus" line, which again,
and she sort of disappears behind the counter, but she disappears.
And then he says, "You do that, and I'll shoot your effing face off."
Yeah, right.
And if she had tried to throw the water at them, as he kind of implies after he has shot her, by saying, "The water, look, it's almost up to our feet." She didn't throw the water at anybody. We would have seen that.
Well, are they trained to de-escalate? Where are we on that? Where, you know, that's one of Brandon Johnson's signature pieces, is to not send police officers into a situation like that. Of course, this started out as a suspicious person on property. This wasn't something else. So you would have sent the cops. But there was at one point, Austin, I don't know if you saw all of the video that I did, where they're saying, "Okay, well, nobody's here." They walk out and then they say, "But let's just take one more look at that other suspicious vehicle." And then they mosey back in. They were this close to getting home free, and it didn't happen. But Austin, just tell me what I should know that you know about de-escalation.
That's not going to be much. I mean, it's critically important for officers to enter a situation like that with a certain mindset. And if your mindset is always scanning for threats and looking for trouble, we all know from our everyday lives that, like, oftentimes you'll find it. So, and that seemed to happen in this case. So it was a horrible tragedy, entirely preventable. And if there was training about de-escalation, it has to be the least effective, I mean, training in the world, because this was such an innocuous circumstance compared to what other encounters people face on a day-to-day basis. If you're a police officer, it's a single woman alone with a pot of water. What about your mindset is creating that as a violent trigger in your mind? So I don't know what the extent of de-escalation training is for the Sangamon County Police Department or Sheriff's Office, but to whatever extent there is that training, it's clearly failed.
Yeah.
He could have simultaneously been backing up.
There was sufficient time
for that, absolutely.
And on the other hand, I know plenty of people of color who have trained their children, especially young Black males, how to de-escalate when faced with the police. The burden for de-escalation right now is largely on the person of color. And in fact, when I work with Indivisible Chicago, we train canvassers to go door knocking. We teach them de-escalation. Don't make direct eye contact. That's seen as hostile. Take a few steps away. Be deferential. Agree, you know, with whatever they say. You know, we all are being trained, and that's not a police confrontation situation so much as a political confrontation. But these families who have young Black male children are always worried about them being out and about, getting pulled over or stopped by police for some reason, and they learn how to de-escalate for themselves. The training needs to be emphasizing de-escalation skills on the police side, and it's way overdue.
An Illinois grand jury indicted former Sangamon County Sheriff's Deputy Sean Grayson. This is the shooter we're talking about, the police officer. He's 30 years old. Last week, he has pleaded not guilty to charges of first-degree murder, aggravated battery with a firearm, and official misconduct. And that's the end of the podcast this week. Just two topics. We could have gone hours on the first one, and we probably will between now and what's the date of the convention, guys? When is it in Chicago? August 17th? 19th
through
22nd. 19th through the 22nd. Oh, yeah. One last thing about that. So what do you guys think of this? This is my closing scene on the final night where, say, it's Kamala Harris and her husband are standing up there and the balloons are falling down and everybody's cheering. You have on the stage, you have the Harrises and you have the Bidens holding up their arms, the four of them kind of in victory. But you also have on the stage Barack and Michelle Obama, Bill and Hillary Clinton, the Bushes and the Kinzingers. Like, create as broad a spectrum of support as you can for the ticket. Like, not only are the Democrats behind it, but give me a who's who of people up on the stage that will energize a voting public, including some cherry-picked Republicans. Who's coming with me on that?
VP choice and his or her family.
Oh, yeah. And then we get the vice president up there.
Yeah, I'll be there too.
They're in the second row. Marge,
they're the key four.
In a million years, does anything like that happen, Marge? Exclude the Bushes and the Kinzingers, maybe. But
I think that, you know, the last two nights are traditionally the VP and then the presidential nominee. And so the last night, you would have heard Harris reintroducing herself and re-energizing the floor, and that's when the balloons drop. She accepts the nomination, and if they have half as many balloons as the Republicans had, that'll be a lot. There was just so many balloons. I think it's entirely possible that those leading Democratic figures will be on stage with her. I think that would be fabulous.
You know what would be great? Since Nikki Haley's PAC has pledged its money to come, wouldn't it be great if Nikki Haley changed her mind yet again? She was part of this great.
This is even crazier than my idea. She's suing the PAC that's using. She's suing the PAC that's using her name because she wants him to stop using her name. Yes, yeah. So
I don't think that's sad.
That is really sad.
I don't think she'd be cheered in that convention hall. You might have gone a step too far, Kate.
All right. Well, we can dream, can't we? I thought John wanted us to dream a little bit.
He did. He did. We'll dream next week. Okay. Austin, Kate, and Marge, thank you for joining us. Eric, thank you for listening, wherever you are. And we're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. All right, campers. Well done. Thank you so much.
All right.
Well done. See ya.
Bye.
Toodles.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.